Hello folks, this is Nilanjana and you are listening to Vitra, the Nisve podcast. Vitra in Navi means soul. And that's kind of apt because this podcast is for the old souls, the ones that like to take a minute to pause, reflect on the bigger questions in life, the ones that want to dive a little deeper and find more meaning in the lives that we lead. So let's get right to it. Hi guys, and welcome to the 11th episode of Vitra. Today we are going to be talking about one of my favorites, books. But not just why books are so awesome or trade book recommendations with you, but today I'm going to take a look at how books, and more importantly access to books, works out to be an empowering element for all sections of the society. And in the process, also examine some of our own biases that we have around reading for pleasure and explore or understand how community libraries can be a powerful way to democratize access to books and how that is beneficial for the society as a whole. So to discuss all of that with me today, I have Mridula Koshi, who is a writer. And she is also a library movement activist and director of the Community Library Project. So, Mridula, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, and thank you, Nilanjana.
Thank you for joining me today. And I think, first up, I would just like to begin by asking you, when is it that your whole experience with books started off? What's your story with that?
I think I had a very typical middle-class childhood in 1970s. And 80s India, in that I had some access to books. Maybe not as much as I should have had. But some. I now work with children and adults, all walks of life, but the vast majority of them are working class kids. And relative to them, I would say my access was pretty good because they have zero. So when I was a kid, I went to convent schools. I went to semi-government schools. I went to well-known private schools. I had a childhood in which my father, who was a service employee, sometimes traveled, sometimes I was in hostels. So it was always the luck of the draw. Like the best year in many ways was class four. I was in a hostel. I was next door that summer to the textbook room. So the books for the next year were delivered and I spent the whole summer reading the non-detailed readers that were for all the classes, for class 4, 5, 6, 7, whatever. So I was a voracious reader. I read anything I could get a hold of. When there was nothing else, I really did read the telephone book, which back then, you know, very few homes had telephones and telephone books, but ours did. And I read my father's five-year plans, and I'm not exaggerating. There's something about the way words felt in my mouth and in my mind that was interesting to me. So in some ways, a kid like me is not the typical kid the library I run serves now. Some people are wired to become readers more quickly than other people are. So maybe I was one of those people who are wired to become readers quickly.
Definitely. So while we get to talking about the access or the importance of access to books in a bit, what I also immediately related to was the fact that when you said if you had nothing else to read, you would go ahead and read the phone book. And I think I remember something like that happening with me as well, in the sense, not exactly phone books, but I remember like anything that came wrapped in newspapers or like any other thing that would, like, even the packaging, I would probably start reading that at some point if I'm like done with all the books. And that's funny, but I also wanted to know from you that what does reading do for you? Like for me, at one point of time when I was a kid, reading used to mean access to different places that I couldn't be in or access to different cultures that I'm not a part of. And yes, that comes from my relatively privileged background that I could just read books as access to other worlds. But for you, what were books? Like, why would you read?
So books potentially are a way of thinking. Now, most often, most people in India are limited to books just as a way of learning. You know, people will talk about knowledge, and that's compared to books as a way of just studying a discrete set of facts. Knowledge is just, however, you know, slightly larger set of facts than maybe the few discrete ones that are thrown at you, which is our nearest star, what is the third largest stadium in the country, who was the first prime minister. So you get these key facts that matter to what, you know, to this particular society. And we've kind of come up with this very, very limited list. And then sometimes we talk about, nahi, we need knowledge hona chahiye. So then we are saying, who wrote Anna Karenina? Or did you read Anna Karenina?
So it's just broadening the set of facts in that.
Yes. No, but I think it's even more than broadening. I mean, when we broaden from studies to knowledge, we've not tapped out what could actually be. What could actually be is that reading could be a way of thinking. Now, when we read a book and we imagine another culture, we're actually thinking. We're exploring our curiosity. We are perhaps acquiring some facts that we could use in a test. We may be acquiring something more than facts. We may be acquiring some larger collection of facts which forms our knowledge of the world. But thinking is so much more than that. Thinking is when we interrogate those facts, when we interrogate that knowledge. For a small child, thinking might be reading a book in which they are in Denmark or Sweden. Maybe they're reading Pippi Longstocking, which is set in Sweden. And they are, in passing, acquiring some facts that might be good for an exam they're going to take 10 years later about the capital of Sweden. But maybe more than that, they're acquiring some knowledge of Sweden as a country or a culture or what they eat. But even more than that, they're thinking that this hilarious character, who is also sort of a heroic and a sort of an unbelievable character, this girl Pippi Longstocking in this story, who can lift horses with bare hands and who lives alone because her father is a sea captain out at sea and her mother has passed away. So like a lot of children's literature, our main character is a orphan, which is like this wonderful thing that children need. They need to explore the possibility of growing up and finding their own way in the world. And so children's literature prepares them for that experience because we're all ultimately, in some existential sense, orphans, right? Without anybody. And so that young 8 or 9 or 10 year old reading Pippi Longstocking is thinking, am I like Pippi? Will I ever have to be alone? Who am I actually? We have this member of our library, a young woman. She's just taken her 10th board exam. She's a member leader in our library. And this young woman was recently talking about people in her neighborhood questioning why she spends late evenings in the library. Late evenings means our library closes at 7 o'clock on Sunday. And on that evening, maybe she reaches home at 7:30. And people up and down the alley, uski gali mein jo log rehte hain, wo poochne lagte hain, ye ladki kahan se aayi, kahan thi? Itni raat ko kya kar rahi thi? What is she doing so late at night? And this young woman, in relating the story of how people are asking questions about her, goes on to then say out loud to all of us who were listening to her, by asking out loud of all of us, but actually asking of herself, who am I? And this is what literature does for us. This is what, when you're 8 years old and you read about an 8-year-old girl who is heroic and impossible and strong and lives without her parents in Sweden, and her name is Pippi Longstocking. And when we read her, we think to ourselves, am I her? Am I me? Who am I?
So was she able to answer that question?
Our 10th standard young woman, her name is Nunihar actually. She's a wonderful thinker, and she started out life in our library by reading Pippi Longstocking. And a really funny thing about her is a lot of people around her who were reading the book at the same time sort of nicknamed her Pippi, because here in Delhi, in this small neighborhood in Jagdamba Camp, which is a Basti community near which our library is situated, a bunch of kids who normally wouldn't be reading books located in Sweden read the book in Hindi. A&A publisher publishes it in Hindi, translates it and publishes it. And they were actually able to tell this young girl, you are heroic and you are strong, you are Pippi. And maybe that played some part in how she was able to answer that question as a 9th and 10th standard girl who's being critiqued in her neighborhood. She was able to answer that question. I don't know what her answer is actually, because what she did in that conversation was just raise the question. you know, these are questions we spend our lifetime thinking and answering. And yeah, we need books to be able to answer these questions really well.
So in a way, they're, I mean, while we are knowing about other people and things happening far off, but essentially the books and the stories in them become a way for us to find out more about ourselves or know ourselves or situate ourselves in different contexts.
Yes. Books give us access to our ability to interrogate ourselves, our actions, our choices. All of that involves thinking. And as I said, we think anyway, but we need to be able to think with Sarojini Naidu. We need to be able to think with Kabir. We need to be able to think with Tolstoy. These are some of the greatest thinkers. When we read their books, we're actually not just thinking with them. We're thinking with every reader who ever read that book, who kept the book alive so it came to us. The more people who are involved in this great human project of thinking with books, not just thinking, but thinking with books, the more I think satisfying this will be for all of us. And the better off we will be in terms of the kinds of democracies we want to create.
All right. So we're saying that thinking with books and consequently thinking with the author and thinking with all the readers that have experienced the book before you, we're saying that becomes a critical part of the human project or the human experience of collective thinking. And if that's true, then how is it that we ended up in a situation where access to books is so unequal and regulated?
So the fact that in India we do not have enough access to books for all people is just the most baffling decision we've ever taken. I think sometimes, maybe even I in my early days, looking at the lack of libraries in India, answered, as many people sometimes still do, that it's just an oversight, or we're a poor country, we can't afford it. Hey, we're not a poor country. I mean, like, the world's billionaires are from India. Nobody becomes a billionaire because they worked that 25th hour of their day. There is no 25th hour of their day. People become billionaires because the collective wealth of many people's labor supports them becoming that. I mean, the worker on the factory floor and out in the field is part of why we have billionaires. So we are a wealthy country. But aside from that, I think we have made choice. It is not that we forgot to create libraries when we created roads and stadiums and really fancy airports. We didn't forget. We decided that it wasn't important. Or we decided that it's best for us to keep on as we are keeping on, limiting people to not being able to read much, or to only going to school and acquiring enough literacy to be able to read for studying, read for using a script to make a call center call or to answer a call center call, but not, you know, reading for thinking. That if we limit it to that, potentially there are things about the society that some people are pleased with. I think we live in a very hierarchical society. It is extremely stratified. One way in which it is hierarchical is some people have access to reading and other people don't. And in another way, we are hierarchical in that that lack of access supports hierarchy. The more access we create, the more egalitarian we are, the more people participate in thinking collectively about the kind of society we want to be. If more people participate, if more information is widely available to more people through more libraries, I think we will look at a more equal society down the road.
All right. So I think one of the things that really hit me is when you said it's not that we couldn't afford to build libraries and that it has been like a decision that was taken and repeated across generations for it to become such a systemic lack of access to books to an entire set of people or entire section of the society.
That's right.
So now when we, and I think you have in parts already talked about it, but what I wanted to understand is that what happens when you do give access or when you do free up access to books for a particular section of the society?
Yeah, I'm really happy to talk about that. A significant section of our country has access to schooling. Our constitution lays it out in the directive principles that people should have access to schooling. What is missing is what people need to use the hundreds and thousands of books a person has to read in their childhood. It could be later in childhood for some people, because if we build access right now, many people are already past age 2, 3, 4, 5. When a child is as young as a few weeks old, parents can start reading to them. If you come from a generation of babies whose parents don't read, then you especially need access to books and people to read to you via a public library system. A good library that means to develop readers who think while reading, interrogate text and use text as a way of thinking their own thoughts. What a good public library does is it's A, free, it's open for everyone, it's welcoming, which means when you come in, you don't have to be frightened, nor of fees, nor of fines, because books are late sometimes because we're human, we forget, or we might even lose a book, or a book might tear accidentally when it falls from our hand despite our best intentions. So that library has to be welcoming. And then it has to provide a range of programming, including baby parent time, baby papa time, baby mommy time, circle of parents and babies, a librarian who comes and sits and reads a story, parents who know how to read, volunteering to read to their neighbors' children whose parents don't know how to read, a community space that people come into and find programming that introduces children at a very young age to books. Older children who haven't had access to books because up until now there hasn't been a library, they need the same thing, a read aloud. When we build libraries that have the kind of programming where a baby can come in and have a book read to them, and in our country, programming where a 14-year-old who reads so haltingly that when they come in and they're eager and interested and they grab a book, but they read so slowly that it's really, really boring to read. Something that happens rather tragically is when you read haltingly and slowly, you can read a workplace manual or be a middle manager, but you cannot read fluently enough to think while you're reading. So here's how reading works. When you're thinking while reading, you hear the voice of the text, which is the words on the page. Maybe you're even reading fluently enough to read it silently in your head. So that's the first voice, the voice of the text, the words that are sounding in your head, or perhaps you're reading so haltingly that they're coming out of your mouth out loud. And maybe your finger is moving across the text to keep you anchored to it, because it's so much arduous intellectual labor, because what you're actually doing is you're decoding. Many children who go to school for all of the years that they go to school come out of school not being able to read fluently. The majority of kids come out not being able to read fluently, which means you read so well and so fast that the text springs off the page at you and you do not decode text. You have all your intellectual energy left over from the act of listening to the first voice of the text to engage the second voice, which is your own voice. So when you're reading the text, you're like, this is totally not true. I don't believe this. Or you're reading about, when I was growing up, we read a lot of Enid Blyton. So we were reading about scones and jams and tarts, and we were wondering what a mince pie is. And I grew up thinking it was something savory, and I think it's actually something sweet. So you're thinking, you said that when you read, you get to travel to other worlds, to other cultures, which means you're actually, your second voice is actually creating images, it's interrogating the text, it's making connections to your own life. You are almost tasting that foreign food in your mouth and rejecting it, finding it appealing, developing a sense of yourself as somebody who might travel in the future, developing a sense of yourself as someone who's curious about the world, who is maybe brave in the world or maybe anxious in the world. So to get people thinking while reading, we literally have to give them books day and night. And that sounds so strange to us because we're not used to it, but it's totally the normal in many places in this world. Right here in India, we have an example in Kerala, a place where in bus stops you will see people reading, and not just textbooks that they're mugging up for school. You will see in every direction, every few kilometers, a library. And on every street corner, someone reading a newspaper. It's not perfect. It's not well-funded enough. And there are problems there. but it's far down the road in the direction that we want to be going in as a country as a whole.
I would also want to give our listeners a bit more context of the library in Sheikh Sarai. So I understand that there is an open community library that's open to everyone. So I just wanted to get a little more information about what that is, how it operates, and sort of what happens when people have this unencumbered access.
So in Sheikh Sarai, we have a little model library. It's open 7 days a week. It's open to everyone. People come in and they say, oh my God, it's a jewel, because it's really teeny tiny and it's stocked with thousands of books. And they're all books you want to read. There's Amartya Sen and there's Kamala Bhasin. So there's economics and there's gender. There's Pippi Longstocking, which I've mentioned many times because it's such a favorite book of mine. And there's Percy Jackson for people who are into fantasy. And there's tons and tons of great Indian writers like Samit Basu and Jeet Tail and Meenakshi Reddy Madhavan. And our library, we run it as a model. A model in the way that when you walk into an architect's office and they're talking about a new city that they're creating, they're able to show it to you in the form of a little glass encased model. Now, ours is not very glass encased. It's a working model. So it's fully functional. We have about 2,500 members, some 95% of whom go to Hindi medium school run by the government. They use the library to the tune of issuing tens of thousands of books a year. This year, because of the pandemic, we've been closed for the last one quarter. We will be closed for some time longer, not just because of the pandemic, but because we lost the building in which we were rent-free. And now we are creating a library really close by because we're not leaving our members. The same 2,500 children are going to continue to need access, and you do not, you know, hang out the hummingbird feeder and then remove it, because the hummingbird depends on the feeder. If you hang it out, it has to be for a lifetime. So our library will continue functioning in that neighborhood. It's just under construction during the pandemic, and we hope to open it in a few months, and it'll be in Khirki Extension. It's going to be lovely. We have always had pro bono help from architects and designers and artists, and children's book illustrators come and paint murals and involve the children in that kind of activity. And all day, every day in the library, books are being issued and books are being read aloud. And one of the brilliant things we do is we have scores of members who, having received dozens, if not hundreds of read alouds, turn around and get training on how to read aloud to their younger siblings. We know from anecdotal evidence that in the community around our library, I'm talking about a 1 kilometer radius, that in the evening when people are having dinner or preparing dinner or after dinner, when they're sitting around, somebody inevitably opens a book from the library and reads it to their parent or their sibling. And parents ask children, ki aaj jo book le aaye kholo, sunao usme kya hai. And people are reading stories like Ladka Jisne Pucha Kyon, The Boy Who Asked Why, which is a chapter of Ambedkar's life from his childhood, rendered as a picture book. And the next day, you know, the young girl in whose house the story was read came to me in the library. Her name is Pinky. She was maybe 12. This was a couple of years ago. She was writing a book report in the library about this book. And we have a lot of programming in the library to get kids engaged. And one of them is this wonderful program called the Honor Roll Program. As soon as you've read your 10th book and turned it back into the library, your name goes up on the wall and a star gets put next to it. You get a packet of Oreo biscuits, which is the one time in the library you get a packet of books, as part of the applause for having read 10 books. But the most important thing is your name is up there, and another 10 books and another star goes up, and another 10 books, another star goes up. When you've read 80 books, which takes about a year for most kids, and Pinky had read 80 books, and when she took this book home, maybe it was her 84th or 89th book, you get a chance to write book reports. And the reason we ask children to do the book reports is because we do a lot of hand-holding with kids as they go through their first 80 books. A lot of that hand-holding takes the form of repeated invitations on a daily basis to sit in a circle of kids and discuss a book after hearing the book read out loud to you. That's the read-aloud program. It's a daily program. But after 80 books, we want to see you not in a circle of 7 or 8 kids. Before you hit your 100th book, we would really like to have 20 opportunities to have a one-on-one with you. So the book report is a complete bahana. It's just an excuse. It's a one-page thing, and we ask you to write the name of the book and the author, and then some thoughts about it. You know, summarize the plot and what did you think? You know, what was great about this book, or what did you not like? Or, you know, the kind of questions that school never asks you. And this young girl, she was reading her book report to me, and she interrupted it and said, "You know what I did yesterday? I read this book at home. And mummy ne kaha ki ye to hamari kahani hai. Ye hamari jati ki kahani hai." And I just, you know, there are times when I say the things I say about our library, and we try to do the things that we say we are doing. And then there are the times when, you know, we see it. It's happening right in front of us. And it was one of those moments, and I had chills, and I felt shaken to think that everything I say, I believe, is actually true. That books do speak to people. Books empower people. Books help you to know who you are and what your history is. And it helps you to catch a glimpse of the future, because this mom knows the story, and she's able to tell her daughter, this urban village little girl far from her mother's childhood, facing different realities here, but for whom caste is still true. And she and her mom get to engage in this dialogue because they have this book about Ambedkar's childhood between the two of them to allow this conversation. And I think the child comes out of that conversation stronger. And I think as a society, we come out of it stronger because she read that book, because Ambedkar got to speak to her. So you asked about what Sheikh Sarai Library looks like. It looks like all these thousands of people reading. When you walk close to the library, like when you get off your auto, you have to walk in because there are these gullies. When you walk in, before you come into the jewel of the library, you'll encounter children. Some of them walking with a book in their hand, going home or coming to the library to exchange a book. And you will see children walking in pairs and one person reading and the other person watching the road to make sure the first one doesn't fall in to whatever uncovered manhole or ditch digging is going on that day. Okay. In other words, all around the library, people are reading, not just inside the library. It's no longer about studying or knowledge. It's about thinking and connecting as a community to thinking with the help of books. And all of the programming in the library and all of the work we do involves all this course correcting. We make mistakes. We rethink things. We develop programs like the Honor Roll program, which has turned out to be a very successful program. Little kids who come into the library on new membership day and put their name down and say, "I want to be part of this library." The first thing they see is 1,400 names marching around the room on the wall, lots of these glittering stars next to the names. So all this stuff is what needs to go into the kind of library system we would like to see the government in this country create. So I think for those who are listening to this podcast right now, some are thinking, "I had books." Some are thinking, "Oh my God, I almost didn't have books." And many others listening to this, even middle-class people, are thinking, "That's not what my childhood looked like. I didn't walk home from a library reading out loud or reading a book while someone walking next to me watched to make sure I didn't fall in. Like, I had a book once in a while." And that kind of experience in our society is something we actually have to decide to undo. And it's going to take more than a government policy or a small organization like ours pushing. And that's why I talk about being a library movement activist, is because we need a whole movement of people. We definitely need the middle class to push, to ask for this, and to not just ask for it for their children, but to ask for it for everybody.
Okay, so I think there are a lot of things that you said. So one is that just hearing about the library itself from you, it just has been very heartening. Like right now I have a huge smile on my face, because what you just said about the children that are there who are able to read and what it's doing for them, that is very heartening in itself. And I think I remember one word that you said is that it's very welcoming. Now, when I think of library, and this is from my upbringing that I have had, that yes, I have had access to books and a pretty privileged childhood, so I had lots of books. But my idea of a library is that it's huge, it's very sacred sort of a place where you're supposed to stay quiet and everybody is serious and there are lots and lots of books and you're supposed to treat each book with so much care, like they would just like fall apart at just a touch.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, and somehow there is this idea created in our heads and in a lot of people's heads that you should treat books with care and you don't lend out books or give books to people who don't value books. And that's a common, that's the term used or that's a phrase used, that people who don't value books or know their value, why would you lend out books to them? But your place doesn't sound like that. The library doesn't sound as if it's stuffy or very formal in that sense. So how do you ever face that argument that people are coming from these backgrounds, they don't know the value of books, what's the point or anything like that?
Yes. So this has to do with the kinds of thinking that we grow up with and the kinds of assumptions built into our society. It has to do with class and caste. And the earliest we recognize this, that when we talk about valuing books, we're talking about devaluing people. The earliest we make this connection, the earliest we can move on and create a different way of thinking. So people who walk into our library often, well-meaning, lovely people, some of them walking in to become volunteers, will look at a room with books that go all the way to the ceiling, as they often do in good libraries. Our library also has books that go to the ceiling. And the top shelves you have to access with a ladder. And there's thousands of books. And it is beautiful. And it is a sacred space. Above all, it's a sacred space because it's full of readers. Because a book is just an object. It becomes something real and something valuable because someone reads it. So people walk into our library and they look at this. And then they turn to me and they say, but how do you know they're reading it? And this is usually after I've already shown them the honor roll with the names and the stars. And I know what they're thinking. They're thinking that I am a fool and everyone who's working with me in this library movement, we're all fools. That these kids, you know, these 6-year-olds and 8-year-olds and 14-year-olds are just making fools of us. That they just come in and take books and go home and come back and they obviously don't read them and they just get their, you know, name up on the wall and they get stars next to the name and that there's this whole charade going on. And, you know, I remember my childhood well enough to know that neither I nor any of my friends were enough energy to do this charade that we're sort of implicitly being accused of. So what I want to say is if a library is very welcoming, as ours is, and I'll tell you a little bit more in a bit about what that welcome looks like, but when a library is very welcoming, people do read. Not everybody will read Amartya Sen or Tolstoy. Some people will read Bhagat Singh and some people will read Rainbow Fairy Pony with Pink Hair. And everyone will read what they want to read and think if we're able to give them enough books, they will become fluent readers who think. And some people will think, I want to see an end to injustice. And some people will think, how can I manage my workers at work and extract more from them? And some people will think, and they're the people who come into the library and ask, and we have lots of books on time management and people management and human resource issues. And and some people will think about how fun it would be to be a pink pony with a rainbow mane and fly in the clouds and meet other pink ponies. So a library is not about some sort of elevated understanding of culture. A good library is about a culture of everybody. So how do we make sure that a library is a welcoming space? Because if it is, then everyone will read and there will be no charade. We cannot say that the book is so important that you as a human being will be excluded from it for being a human being. Errors are something that happen by anybody who's human. And that's why it's called a human error. So people who are people will make mistakes. And we say this to little children on their first day. We say, aapse zarur aane wale saal mein, kahin na kahin, kabhi bhi, pata nahi kaise, book khoya jayega. Sometimes I'll tell a long exaggerated story just to get the kids smiling. I'll say, you might be running, you might be rushing home. Suddenly there will be a ditch and you'll trip trying to avoid it and a mad dog will chase you and the book will go flying and it'll land in that ditch. And who will be responsible for that book being muddy and unusable by the next reader? And the child will nod and say, I will. or will resist the idea, and I'll coax them into saying, yes, you will be responsible. And will you have to pay a fine? Will you be barred from the library? Will you be told, key, you are not worthy of books? No, you will not be told that. We have a lovely policy. No late fees, no fines, no lost book payments, no security deposit. Not one paisa ever passes from a member's hand into the library coffer. And this is actually policy all over the world in the best libraries. This is how you undo centuries of people not being able to read, because that person coming into the library is not coming into a neutral space, and nor are they coming from a neutral space. They're coming from a space where there's hierarchy in the classroom, in the home. They come from homes where maybe they don't have running water or a toilet and they have to use the communal bathroom. So they already know what the world is. They don't think that everybody in the world goes without a toilet. The lovely mall, Saket Mall, is not far from us. And every one of our library members, even the six-year-old, has seen how glittering it is on the inside. When they come into the library, they know which world they're coming from. And when they come in, our welcome has to be one where they see that there is the possibility of a slightly better world. And part of what's better about it is that you are going to be seen as someone who is going to be an amazing reader and an amazing thinker with books. And if you lose a book, it's because you're human. And all of us are capable of losing books and damaging books. And you will be forgiven. And there's this day called Repair Day. Repair Day is every Thursday. You can come into the library. If you're 4 years old, you can bring your mother or your sister, older sister. If you are 10 or 12 years old, we will ask for as much as 2 to 3 hours. If you're an adult, you can pay for the lost book. I can't think of even once in the time that we have run the library where someone has come and paid for the book. We have had members whose mothers clean and sweep and mop in other people's homes who have come in with 3 or 4 books in their hand and said, Madam ne mummy ko diya tha, maine pad liya hai, kya ye main library ko donation mein de sakti hu? So our library members, because of their warm welcome, do become readers. Sometimes people walking into the library who raise these questions, even after seeing an honor roll with names marching across it to the tune of, you know, almost 1500 names. Sometimes these people actually have a child sitting right in front of them reading or reading aloud to another child and still say to me, do they really read? So I would say that there is probably a problem in our ability to see and understand what's in front of us, because we have inherited these horrible systems of disenfranchising people, systems in which we on Facebook will share posts where we talk about how we buy books that we never get around to reading. And we celebrate our, not just consumerism, but presumably our intellectualism, that ki mere paas itne sare books hai ki main kabhi bhi ye sare nahi pad paungi. And did you know there is a Japanese word or a French word for a reader like me, one who is, you know, so greedy that she acquires many more books than she can read? But we hold our working class child to a standard that tumne padha na, ghar leke gaye aur padke hi wapas kiye hai na. No, so in our library, as a matter of policy, we are not allowed to talk to members about whether they completed a book, except for the pedagogical reason that we want to engage them in thinking about the book. Acha pasand nahi aaya to chhod diya beech mein. Acha ye shayad aapke level ke na thodi si bahar hai. Let's find you a book. Last week aapne sports ke book liye the. Aapko pata hai pura ek section hai sports ke books ke. So, you know, the most popular book in our library in the Lanjana is from our drawing section. It's a book about drawing. And some people might make meaning out of it, like, you know, working class people, they're never going to read. They're only going to take books for drawing. I see it as providing the books people want to read. And yeah, there are people in our library who read Tolstoy who might not have read Tolstoy if they didn't have the access. We are a diverse group of people. The majority of children in the library want to read a book about drawing. They want to take it home and it tells them how to copy a picture of a flower or a mountain, and they do it for a homework assignment or they do it to show off to their teacher. And that's good. On a different day, that same child might be the child who reads a highfalutin book or some other book. And who am I to judge?
Yes. So I think so when you concluded by saying that whether they're taking like a drawing book or whether they're reading Amartya Sen or about Little Pink Pony, and both lead to different kinds of thinking, but it still allows people to start thinking. And I think that becomes very important because as people who have had the privilege to read and read for pleasure, we also have this classism or this habit of making judgments about people based on the kind of book they are reading. And I can't say that I haven't ever indulged in it because I have. But it starts off a sort of vicious cycle where people are reading something and you think that them reading this is not really high literature or something like that. And we do it to our peers and we definitely do it to people who would be maybe from a lower socioeconomic background than us. And that just starts off a vicious cycle where they feel shamed for reading something and they don't end up picking it up again or reading anything else because the other stuff seems to be outside of their capabilities at this moment.
So books don't make people thinkers, right? Because as we said earlier in this conversation, people are thinkers already. Books are a tool and probably the most powerful tool any of us could ever have access to. I mean, short of hearing Ambedkar talking to us today, because, you know, books make Ambedkar immortal. And that's a pretty powerful thing to be able to do. And to read Ambedkar is to hear him again. I think that we all want a more thoughtful society. So there's no getting away from the fact that to get there, we have to make sure everyone has access to all the reading they want to do. And if we fail to see someone reading when they are in fact reading, we probably need to figure out what our ignorance is, what is tripping us up. What matters in access is access. What matters in access is not a test for who should get access. When you set up access, it is not genuinely access if we say, hum book aapko denge agar aap padenge. We just set up access by giving people books. Whether they read it or not is dependent on them. What they choose to read is dependent on them, in my experience. And other people don't have enough experience at this moment, given the lack of libraries, to come here and tell me that my members are probably not reading. I have experience, so listen to me. In my experience, when you provide access, people read, and it makes them more powerful thinkers, and it makes us a more thoughtful society.
All right. So I think the thing you said about access becomes very powerful, that giving access just means giving access, not who you give access to, what they do with the access, no qualifications to it, basically.
That's right.
So if I were to bring this thing around and ask, what is it that we can do, people like us who have been able to read for pleasure or who have had the privilege to read for pleasure, and if we want to help with this expansion of access, how is it that we could help or get into it?
So there is a kind of nascent library movement. There are good organizations like the Community Library Project, of which I'm a part. There are good organizations like this all over the country. We are one of the stronger ones here in Delhi, and there are a few other community libraries in Delhi, but either smaller or maybe as part of some other NGO work that they're doing. Here in Delhi, we are the ones who are doing it as the main thing that we're doing, and the only thing that we're doing, library activism. So you can think about joining the movement. Joining the movement can take the form of helping us with funds. It can take the form of coming in and volunteering. And it can take the form of come find us on Facebook, like what we're doing. Start participating in the conversation. When we respond to the pandemic by pointing out that the internet is not an equal space, just like all of society is an unequal space, so the internet too. And when the government and the private sector starts making available on the internet alternatives to being able to go to school, because now we're in a pandemic and we can't go anymore, children are once again receiving unequally. As a library, when we went online on Twitter and we had library members here, our 15, 16, 17-year-old, also library activists, they go by the name Student Council. We have a couple of dozen of these youngsters. They overnight learned how to make Twitter accounts and started tweeting, and we had a Twitter storm. You could have been part of that, but you know, if you weren't, that's okay. It's not too late. Come join the movement. You'll find us on social media, and we'll give you many, many opportunities, because our library has become a platform through which to get our voices and our issues heard. And when we had the Internet Colo campaign a couple months ago, and it's still ongoing, these sorts of things will keep happening in the future because the issues aren't going away. The pandemic is here, unequal access is here. Libraries are unequally available to people. Education is unequally available to people. We are the people speaking about it. Don't make the mistake of thinking that we first need to give people rations and then we need to talk about books. We can do both. Nothing is stopping us from doing both at the same time. So I would say that your listener is welcome to join at all levels. I also want to add that we need money. How do we run free libraries? Because we're funded by people like you.
All right. So for people who are listening to the podcast right now, you can go ahead and join the Community Library Project, whether that's first on social media or by funds or by going ahead and volunteering at the library. So there's a lot that you can do. And
can I add one quick thing?
Sure. Go ahead.
We've also spent the last 4 months working around the clock to create a digital library, much of it in Hindi. It's on our website. And lots of volunteers are needed to help us create content for this website, for our digital library. And as in the physical library, volunteers are mainly reading books out loud. And it's not just audio, it's audio and it's video, depending on how much data and access people have. We have about 2,000 kids who are receiving stories twice a day, 3 days a week right now in this format through WhatsApp.
That is wonderful, actually. And yes, if any of our listeners would like to volunteer in that manner, that would also be a great thing to do. All right, Mridula, so this has been really enlightening and really joyous, actually, to talk to you about this. Because while I talk about books a lot, I have never really paid so much attention to what access to books means and what it has done for me and what it means for the kind of person I am today, and how that same access to books could mean very transformational for a lot of people. So yeah, it's been a completely eye-opening conversation. So thank you for joining me on the podcast.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
Great. So that's all we have for today's episode. We will be with you next week with another episode of Vitra. Till then, this is Nilanjana signing off. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you like the conversation, do share this episode with your friends and family. We at Nisve would love to hear from you guys. So if you have any suggestions, ideas about topics we can cover in the future, or simply want to get into a deep and meaningful conversation with us, reach out to us at podcast@nisve.com. You can also connect with us on any of our social media handles. It's Nisve on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Finally, make sure to follow Vitra on Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or Stitcher, wherever you get your podcast fix, to never miss an episode.